It's an honor and a pleasure to be here. I appreciate the invitation of being part of this Reformation 500 commemoration and celebration. And everything I've heard so far is just off the charts great. So I think you're getting about a three-hour college credit if you come to all the sessions on church history, Reformation church history. I appreciated what's been said earlier about the fact that we are unaware of most of the Christians who have ever lived. I mean, 300 years from now, most of us aren't even going to be a memory. We're not going to be known. We will have lived, fulfilled the purposes for which God had sent us, fulfilled our callings as God has called us, hopefully built up his church and expanded his kingdom through our meager labors. And then we are gone, like the grass that withereth. And after two or three generations, we're just a name on a genealogy table or a genealogy chart. So it is with most believers who have lived down through history. We don't know who they were. We don't know what they did. But one thing that we do know is that God has always had a faithful remnant in every place and at all times. And we'll be reminded of this over and over this week. When we talk about the Reformation, we're going to hit the main men who we knew. We know what they were doing and how God used them. But these men were preaching to congregations of hundreds and thousands of people who were converted and just lived normal Christian lives, and we don't know who they were and what they did or how the gospel transferred from them to the next generation on down. But we know what happened. I can say that I can trace my Scottish heritage all the way back to the Covenanters and Covenanter martyrs, and I can see every other generation since then has been a founder of a church in the United States, first in colonial America and then in the United States, right up until my own father. And there is this covenantal heritage that we have, not necessarily our DNA, literally. For most people, you can't trace their families like that, but a spiritual DNA that we are tracing back to those who took a stand in the day of battle for Christ. And we are the heritors of that. All of us are, regardless of what our ethnic background might happen to be. And so when we look at church history and we examine, especially the Reformation, we're looking in a mirror because we are the product of all that has gone on before. And God commands us to look back and see his mighty hand, and we will see it throughout this week in so many ways. A lot of what we know about early church history in the British Isles, and I'm going to be speaking primarily about Scotland. You're going to get kind of a thumbnail sketch of all of Scottish history today, except maybe up until the present time, although I will say a few things about that in the end. But what we do know, oftentimes, the further back we go, there's less and less detail that's for sure. Or that we know, or that has a reliable record. And so some of the aspects of early church history, especially in Scotland and Ireland, is a very, we see through a glass very darkly when we look back to even the medieval times. And for those that we are looking for, the faithful remnant that we search for in the hills and the valleys and the towns, are only revealed to us through trial transcripts made by Catholic prelates when they were trying to determine whether they'd burn a Lollard at the stake or behead him or hang him. And they kept trial transcripts, and that's how we know about some of our spiritual forefathers, is that they ended up in court for their lives, which were then forfeited because of their testimony for Christ. And that's all we know about them. But we do know some things, and oftentimes you have to read between the lines. The other thing that we have, the other source of information we have on the old church in Scotland among the Celtic people, are the records written by the monks who were literate and who wrote things down about monks who were special or churchmen that did remarkable things, except that every year that went by, they did more and more remarkable things, especially after they died. And so when we get into the medieval church in Scotland, we find all kinds of curious things about people that you know and I know simply are not true. But there is much that they did record. You know, when Adamnan wrote his history of Columba and Iona, although it was removed by several hundred years, there was still true things that had gotten down through those ages. But the fact that they wanted to make him a super Christian, a saint, they had to add miracles, because that's how a person became a saint in the Roman Church, was through the performance of miracles. And so they added things to the life. And with careful scholarship and study, you can find out quite a bit about particular individuals. And so I can't give you lots of details about the early church in Scotland. I'll tell you what we do know and maybe speculate a little bit and draw from that. But I want to get us up through the Middle Ages and up to the dawning of the Reformation in Scotland. And it's a dawning that's going to really begin with martyrdom. It's going to start with one and then another, and then martyrs all over the place, and then within a few years, all of Scotland is reformed and believing and covenanting as a Christian nation. It's an amazing tale. Christianity appears to have been brought to Ireland and Scotland and Britain with the Roman soldiers. When Rome conquered the British Isles, conquered England, there were Christians among the soldiers, and there are records of British Christians fairly early on after Julius Caesar made his appearance in Britain, and then followed up by other generals and Caesars who came to Britain. And with them came the gospel, came Christian people, Christian soldiers, camp followers, other Christians who showed up. And then there were converts among the Britons. And so there was a church, using the term in its broad sense, people who truly believed in the just immediate post-apostolic era. We don't know a great deal about them, but there are references to them from time to time. And in fact, someone like St. Augustine mentions that there was a church council, and there were representatives there from the Christian churches of Britain. And even before Augustine, there are references to pastors coming to a church council somewhere in the Middle East or Southern Europe. So Christianity appears to have been brought there early on, but we don't really have any record of much in the way of specific individual names or stories until a man who, his first name is Saint and his second name is Patrick. That's the only two names I've ever heard him have. But Patrick was likely a Scot, actually. He was from North Britain, anyway, and he was a shepherd, and he was a member of a Christian family. His parents were believers. He had heard the gospel. And one day some pirates showed up, and he got kidnapped, taken to Ireland. And there he worked as a slave and was tending sheep. And one day, according to his own record, his own hand, God spoke to him and told him to get his way home and that he had great things in store for him. And we do know that Patrick did make his way. He ran away as a slave and made his way probably to France and received some training there as a ministerial candidate of some sort. But he returned to Ireland, returned home to his family, and then returned to Ireland as a missionary. And he's really the first one that we know of that preached the gospel across Ireland and ended up founding dozens and dozens of small bodies of believers in Ireland. And it wasn't too much after him. There was a church then in Ireland, a Christian church, and it had a very strong Celtic flavor. The people of Ireland were Celts, as were the people of Scotland. The Scots themselves probably originated in Ireland and came over in the mists of time. There was another group there, too, probably also Celts. They were known as the Picts, and they dominated Scotland, and especially in the Highlands, for centuries unknown. We know very little about them, but we know they were part of this great Celtic migration that came from beginning in Central Europe, probably up around the Russian steppes, and then down into Gaul, where France is, and then scattered from there in different directions. And a group of them even ended up in the Middle East. And the Apostle Paul wrote a letter to the Celts, the Celtic people that lived in Asia Minor. And that's the book of Galatians. Galatians is the same word for Gaelic, which was the language that they spoke, or Gaulic. Sometimes they were called Gauls. And certainly that's who Julius Caesar ran into when he conquered Gaul. Many of them were of Celtic tribal origins. And they were the ones who came to Ireland and North Britain into Scotland. So Patrick established the church. And if you go to Ireland today, of course, wherever you go, everybody has a Patrick shrine or a Patrick cathedral. In the town of Armagh, there's St. Patrick's Cathedral, Church of Ireland, which is Protestant, and there's another huge St. Patrick's Cathedral, Roman Catholic, in the same town, two cathedrals on different hills, staring down at each other over the last several hundred years, and both claiming St. Patrick. By the Protestants built their church on top of St. Patrick's first church that he had built. So they have a primacy of place, thanks to the English conquest of Ireland. But wherever you go, there is some way they relate every historical site in Ireland to Patrick in some way. But the reality is that he did lead many. It was a pagan country. It was Druidic religion, and he led many to Christ. He was followed by others, the most prominent being a nobleman by the name of Colum Keel. That became his nickname, and then he comes down to us as Columba. And eventually he was sainted in the Roman church and called St. Columba. So we got St. Patrick and St. Columba. But I find it very difficult to see how the Roman church, the Latin church, can claim these two men. For they were certainly of the Celtic variety of church. In fact, it's interesting to note that many church historians today believe that the Celtic church was much, much closer to what we would call today Eastern Orthodoxy, that they identified with the Patriarchy of Alexandria and the Patriarchy of the Middle East, rather than with the Pontiff, the Pope in Rome, and Latin Christianity. Celtic Christianity was different from the way it developed in the Latin-speaking and Latin church of the West. They were much more identified with the Eastern church. And again, there's a great deal of study that has gone into trying to prove that or disprove that, because everybody wants to claim both Patrick and Columba. But that's back in the 5th century. So we're talking, 400 and 500 years after Christ is where this time period lands. And by the way, I appreciate the timeline in the back of the book. It's important to have it there. And we're going to go right up to George Wishart. So if you're looking at your timeline, we're going to cover the whole space in this hour between the early, off the chart, by the way, earlier than that, up to George Wishart. Tertullian of Carthage and Origen of Alexandria refer to Christians in Britain around 300 AD. And there were also three martyrs who were mentioned under the Diocletian persecution in the same time period from Britain. So we know that the Celtic Church certainly existed at that very early time, and the British churches are mentioned as having bishops and presbyters and deacons, that is, pastors elders, deacons, but within sort of the monastic framework. Columba at Iona is a key figure in the early Christian history of Scotland. The hagiography by Adamnan, who was the ninth abbot of Iona, tells us most of what we know, actually, for sure about Columba. But we know that he did bring at least 12 monks with him to the little tiny island of Iona in the western Isles of Scotland. And if you want to go on our history tour, we go there and spend 2 days on Iona. But that's where his monastery was established, and where he sent missionaries to northern Europe. They went all the way up into northern Europe and to the Scots and the Picts. And it's believed Columba even went to the capital in Scotland of the land of the Scots, which was called Dalriada at the time, and went to the capital city, and that the king of the Scots was converted, having heard the gospel from Columba. So he is a key figure. In the 800s, Iona was abandoned. Of course, the Vikings, when they came in the 9th and 10th century, the first place the Vikings ever went, wherever they raided in the British Isles, and including Scotland, were the monasteries. And that is going to lead into one of the big problems of the Middle Ages with the Christian Church, and that is the monasteries were centers of great wealth. The monasteries owned lots of lands and lots of property and gold and silver and images and treasures. And so when the Viking hordes for about a century came down on Scotland and Ireland and Britain, that's where they went first, to wherever the monasteries were located, and kill all the monks, take all their stuff, and either set up a colony or move on. And that's what happened, and Iona was eventually abandoned by the monks. But for centuries, the sea kings of the Western Isles of Scotland were buried in Iona. So there's a cemetery there that has, I don't remember how many, 40 kings buried there. It's a very fascinating place. But the church was established, and it was established in Scotland in various places. Eventually, the Picts were amalgamated with the Scots, and everybody eventually became known as Scots. The Picts disappeared from history. But churches and monasteries were founded all over the Western Isles, on Tiree, on Mull, Islay, Skye, Kintyre, all the islands, and then on the mainland as well. And so by the 400s, and especially by the 500s, there were lots of churches and lots of Christians in Scotland. Now, what they actually believed is a little difficult to determine. At some point, the Pope in Rome decided that Scotland was much too Celtic, and that he sent one of the princes of the church to England and called for a synod at a place called Whitby, and they invited all the bishops, that is all the pastors, in Scotland and Ireland to come to this collocation. And there, in fact, the Roman, the representative of the Pope's name was Augustine. It wasn't the Saint Augustine, it was a man who adopted his name later on, but he was kind of like the stormtrooper of the Pope. And he came there to force the Celtic Church to abandon their peculiarities that were different from the Latin Church. Now, sorry to say, the big debate, the two biggest issues that they debated over and were almost willing to go to the stake over, was the correct date for Easter in the liturgical calendar and how monks should wear their tonsure, that is, how their hair should be cut. You know, the Celtic monks cut their hair in a certain way, and the Latin monks cut their hair in a certain way, and one of them had to be right and representative of orthodoxy. And that's where the big debates were. They didn't debate over whether you should be praying to the Blessed Virgin or whether you should be praying to the saints, or indulgences, or all the other appurtenances that have been accumulated over the centuries. And that is one of the interesting things that was referred to earlier today and yesterday is all the overlays of church dogma and doctrines that had been added since apostolic times. In debating Catholic friends in the past, they think one of their most formidable arguments is, well, we belong to the real Christian church because our church has never changed. It's always been exactly the same. And I've got a list of 50 different doctrines that were added in the post-apostolic era right up until modern times, none of which are in the Bible, not a one of them. And by the time of the Reformation, most of those had already become orthodoxy in different parts of the empire. Now, when we think of the Christian church of the Middle Ages, we can't think in terms of everybody believed the same thing every place you went. It simply was not the case. The church was a much more fluid kind of institution. Now, the closer to Rome you came, the more hidebound the doctrine was and the more subservient the people had to be. And as they said in those days, the further from Rome, you know, the further from the papacy, the closer to God. And so as you get out to northern Scotland and places in Ireland, you're so far from Rome and the papacy that there are probably all kinds of anomalies and beliefs that don't measure up. In fact, the Roman Catholic Church never actually set down all of the specific doctrines that they believed. And when I say Roman Catholic Church, the Christian Church in its Roman Catholic Christendom sense of the term, they never, until the Council of Trent, they never actually set down what all Catholics believe for all times. And now at Trent, they did do that. And they added Council of Trent was part of the Counter-Reformation. The Catholic Church did not lie down during the Reformation. They counterattacked, and they counterattacked ferociously, as you'll hear about and see as we talk about these things. But part of it was to set down in writing exactly what the Christian Church believes. And so the Pope called the Council of Trent. They met over a long period of time, many years. They invited Protestants to come and make a contribution. But, you know, most Protestants figured their contribution would be their head. And so they weren't about to go and debate the doctors of the church on any particular doctrine. And when the Council of Trent finally formalized what they believed, they issued 125 anathemas, that is, curses. If you believe this, you are accursed forever. And among those, of course, were the solas of the Reformation. If you believe that salvation is by grace alone, without good works, as being part of your salvation, let you be accursed. Let you rot in hell forever, for you are a heretic. And there are 125 of these curses. And we probably fall into a goodly number of them, actually. Most of them, perhaps. If you believe this, you are cursed. And so they defined what they believed. And but not really in the same way until the Council of Trent. So when we talk about Scotland and the church, we just don't know. We're pockets of believers here and there, how long they were able to perpetuate any kind of anything that would resemble biblical orthodoxy as we understand it today. But some of the reform movements in the church did come to Scotland. And we do know that there were believers as early as in the Middle Ages, of course, as Wycliffe and following Wycliffe. Now, someone else is going to handle Wycliffe and the Lollards. I'll just make a couple comments about them in a few minutes. Scotland emerges from its isolation from the rest of the world and becomes part of Western Christendom during the Middle Ages, in the 11th century, really. Malcolm III, often known as Malcolm Canmore, invaded England just before William of Normandy did. 1066, William came over from France. And by the way, Normandy is going to become the most Protestant province in France during the Reformation. The concentration of Huguenots in France is going to be Normandy. That's going to be one of the key places. But not yet. William of Normandy comes across in 1066, conquers England. Malcolm comes to England and marries a Margaret Atheling, who's an Anglo-Saxon princess. They had six sons and two daughters, and they were brought up, quote, strictly in the fear of the Lord. And three of the sons became kings of the Scots. But Margaret herself was instrumental in enforcing the use of Latin instead of vernacular. So instead of any kind of vernacular Gaelic, replaced in the church altogether under Malcolm Canmore with Latin, and celibacy for the clergy. Till the 11th century, the idea of celibacy, even among many of the monks, was kind of a cursed idea, especially in Ireland and Scotland in the early days. Monks, many of the monks were married, and even in the cloisters or even in the monkish communities that they established, they had married places for married monks to live. So strict celibacy doesn't really come in until it's imposed by the Latin Church in the 11th century. Now, many monks were celibate by voluntarily in the Celtic Church, but celibacy for clergy was enforced after 1075. And they moved the headquarters of the Celtic Christianity to Dunfermline in Scotland from the island of Iona, so that the bishops could keep a closer eye on the whole papal system that was being established. Margaret instituted Queen's Ferry, which is still there. It's called Queen's Ferry, and there's a bridge that crosses over the Firth of Forth right at Queen's Ferry. This Margaret in the 11th century had a ferry installed there, named after her, but it had one major purpose, and that was to help pilgrims, Christian pilgrims from Britain, get to the town of St. Andrews. And at St. Andrews was a magnificent cathedral that was constructed around this time. And the belief was that the little finger of St. Andrew was, they had gotten it as a relic, and they started collecting other relics, and it wasn't long before they had enough things to build three true crosses and six crowns of thorns of Christ, and they were all put inside the altar at St. Andrew's. So it became a pilgrimage site, and one of the great aspects of pilgrimage in the great for the priests and the monks and the church, is the people spent money. They came to town for an extended period of time. And at St. Andrews, it was thought that if you went and looked at the alleged little finger of St. Andrew, you would be healed of your diseases. So all the sick people are coming to making pilgrimages to St. Andrew for healing and for blessing and for all kinds of spiritual reasons as well as physical. And psychological reasons. They came to St. Andrews to come to the altar and look at to look at all of the relics. And that's going to play a key role in the Reformation, frankly, especially at St. Andrews, because the cardinal, eventually there's going to be a cardinal in St. Andrews, member of the Roman Curia, and he's the one who is going to do the big crackdown on reformers, because the church is losing income. Pilgrims stop coming to look at the relics. And so it became early on in the 11th century a vacation destination for the good pilgrims of Europe. The Normans came to Scotland as counselors, as officers of state, and as sheriffs. And so you see this sort of amalgamation of French influence in Scotland, and Scotland's going to have a special relationship with France itself, and that's going to play into the Reformation story a little bit later. Neither the English nor the Normans had much consort whatsoever with the Highlanders. They were just considered wild Scots, barbarians that lived in the mountains, and it was too dangerous to go up there. An entire Roman legion disappeared during the Roman times. They sent the 9th Legion up to conquer the Picts, and they were never seen or heard from again. There have been a couple movies made about that, but it's all speculation because then there weren't any survivors. So the people lived in the Highlands were still highly suspect even during the Middle Ages. Although they did adopt Roman Catholicism and adopted it deeply, in a number of the clans did there, and held on to it even up until this day. It was also mentioned that there were other reform movements in the church. I liked what Colonel Eidsmo said, that it was the difference between, now I can't remember what it was he said, the difference between deep reform and, oh no, it was repairing cars. That's what it was. Just doing a tune-up versus an overhaul. And what the church needed was an overhaul, and all it got was tune-ups. Well, let me tell you about some of the tune-ups that thought they were going to be overhauls, because it becomes the story of the medieval Scotland, as well as other places in Europe, especially in Scotland. The way the church was established is monasteries were the center of the church's activity all over the place. And the monks took special allegiance, personal allegiance, typically, to the papacy, to the Pope himself. And that way, he could circumvent the civil authorities, the princes and the kings. So there was always animosity between the papacy and their subject kings in various kingdoms, especially between the Pope and the French king, especially. Eventually, Henry VIII, of course, is going to create an enormous problem for the papacy. In Scotland, Scotland is not as royally powerful in ruling. It's a minor backwater in Christendom, and the nobility really decide who's going to be the king and who's going to lead them, and when they don't like him, that's the end of it, and you pick somebody else. So really the government of Scotland was kind of decentralized, and that in some ways worked to the advantage of the church because of the power of the monasteries. And frankly, when a nobleman who might have lived a very ignoble life wanted to ensure that he was going to go to heaven, he left property to the monasteries and money to say masses for his soul after he was gone. And so that's one way that they accumulated all this wealth, is that people of substance wanting to buy favor with God would pay the monasteries and the monks to take care of that after they were gone. And so they were highly subsidized over a long period of time, especially with property. And that's going to play into the Reformation. Because when the Reformation comes, and people like John Knox are going to say some very damaging things about monasteries and monks not being in the Bible and being idolaters and sitting on great wealth and properties, and that's not biblical, a lot of the nobility said, yeah, we know just what you mean. We're going to become Protestant too. And that's how the iconoclasm and the destruction of the monasteries took place, is the nobility wanted their stuff. It's like the Vikings did. And the Reformation gave them opportunity for that. So some of them were just opportunists in the Reformation, but many of them were very godly men. But we'll get to that in the coming days. Well, a new monasticism grew up during the Middle Ages, and some of it has been referred to already. Now, parish churches, the individual parish where the average person would attend on Sunday, would attend Mass on Sunday, were given to abbeys or monasteries, near or far. So every parish church was attached, or was owned, I should say, by a monastery or by an abbey. There were Kelso, for instance, the monastery at Kelso had 37 parish churches, and they might be 80 miles away and they never meet them or see them, but they get the revenues from the land. Whatever the priest can collect in their parish goes right to the owners of the land, which is the monastery. And so there was this diversity of parishes all over the place, but they're concentrated. The ownership of the land and the funneling of the funding goes into the monasteries from those. Holyrood had 27 parishes and Arbroath 33. And the revenues, of course, flowed to the monks. The old Celtic monasticism had passed away. This wasn't anything like the original monasticism of the Celtic monks of Columba and Patrick and others of that ilk. There was a movement within the Celtic Church that stayed, that didn't change, at least not at the level that everybody else did. They were known as Chaldees. And among the Chaldees, there were likely groups of true believers. They were still within the folds of the church, but they kept a lot of their Celtic ways within the church. And some of them lasted right up until the Reformation. Now, they were good Catholics, but, well, in some ways they were bad Catholics is really the problem, is they were outside the monastic system. And they held to some of the old ways. And we don't know a lot about the Chaldees. And it would be speculation to say any more about them. But they were just a little bit outside the system, but there weren't very many of them. But the old Celtic monasticism was dead. And the Chaldees themselves were no longer a monastic. During the 12th century, they had all kinds of connections with France, where some of this reform of the church, attempted reform of the church, really began. The Cluniacs, the Benedictines, those who followed the discipline of Saint Benedict, Bernard of Clairvaux being by far the most important and most powerful, second most powerful man probably in Christendom. Bernard of Clairvaux he wasn't as powerful as the Pope, but he was very, very powerful there in Cluny, in France, and he sent his Benedictines far and wide, and brought various built monasteries that looked to the monastery at Cluny in France as their headquarters. In Scotland, the Benedictines had monasteries at Dunfermline, Kelso Abbey, Arbroath, and Paisley. Now, the Augustinians was another attempt to reform the church. The Augustinians actually, at first, they didn't call themselves Augustinians because they liked the theology of St. Augustine. What they liked about him were his ascetic writings, the writings that he did in regards to establishing monasteries and ascetic living and that sort of thing. And they liked the fact that he was a great scholar. And so the Augustinians tended to be scholarly and to be teachers. They liked to teach. But they were a mendicant order, and so they traveled around a lot. They were called canons rather than monks. They were less strictly regulated. They were allowed to serve in the cathedrals or as parochial ministers. And they were the ones who were most numerous in Scotland. And that's going to work to the advantage of the Reformation again, in that these were men, many of whom studied the scriptures. And that's going to play a key role when the Reformation comes. So most of the majority of monasteries were Augustinian. And then there were the Cistercians. They were vigorously ascetic. They're the ones who had the rock as a pillow for their head. And they emphasized quality control. All of their monasteries were well endowed. There's very little known about them. It's not known how they recruited or how obedient they really were. But there were a number of Cistercian monasteries across Scotland, too. Remember, the monasteries are the center of religion. It's where people look to for their spiritual nourishment from the monks. And, you know, just a study of monasticism is a fascinating look at man's ability to earn his way to heaven through ascetic practices. And then, of course, the most strict were the Carthusians. But the Cistercians had monasteries at Melrose, Kinloss, Moray, Newbattle, Cupar, Angus, Bellarmino, and Sweetheart Abbey, one of the ones that we visit. So through the 1200s and the 1300s, there is this development of all of these new attempts at getting men back to more ascetic practices and denying the flesh and denying mammon and dedicating themselves to God and to prayer and to separating themselves from the world. But during the 1300s, kind of the opposite happened. The world came in. The more you try to separate yourself from the world and live a monkish kind of life, the more the devil enters in at the gate. And that happened all across Europe within the monasteries. There were always men there who were depraved, who were seeking wealth, who succumbed to all the temptations of the flesh and of prosperity. And they were just known as, in many places, just as the most corrupt people morally in the world. Yet at the same time, they had the ear of God. And they were the ones you had to go through to find forgiveness for your sins. So it was quite a remarkable system with the Pope at the top and then down through the church hierarchy, down to the abbeys and the monasteries and their leadership. The Scottish monasteries were all placed under the Pope. The key to the function of the church were the bishops, the men who actually chose who the parish priests were going to be, the men who liaisoned with the papacy. And in 1124, there were only two bishops in Scotland. And by 1155, there were nine. In other European countries, there were many, many more bishops. And so the bishops didn't have the same kind of influence as in other countries. The Franciscans were a new attempt at reforming the church. They followed St. Francis of Assisi, and that was what they said was a return to the poverty of Christ, and they sent missionaries all over the world. And they were also a mendicant order. That means they begged for a living. And a lot of people resented that, but they said Christ, they debated, they had long debates over questions like, did Christ own the cloak that he wore? Those kinds of really important questions. And the Franciscans said, no, he did not. He didn't own any property at all. And the Dominicans took issue with that. They were rich. In fact, Cluny was the wealthiest place on the planet. It was the wealthiest monastery on earth, and Bernard of Clairvaux oversaw millions of dollars of wealth and gold and precious stones. And in fact, they became the holding cell for the Crusades. Crusaders go off to the Holy Land. They'd leave their money and their property with Bernard of Clairvaux's Cluniacs. And, of course, most of them never came back. Most of them died in the Crusades, and their money went into the treasuries of the monk houses. And the Franciscans came along and said, that's all bad stuff. And you need to pursue poverty. So you have one order that's pursuing wealth and prosperity. It says God wants us to be rich, and certainly the Pope agreed with that. And there were a few reformist popes I can throw in there, but never any that were willing to give up the vast wealth that was flowing into Rome from all over their empire. But then you had people like the Franciscans who said that poverty is what is the ideal of Christ, and not owning any property. And so you have these rival movements. The men who followed St. Francis were called friars, and they had quite a few. They had quite a few monasteries in Scotland also, and they even divided into different denominations of Franciscans. And then, of course, the Order of St. Dominic, who came, they specialized in rooting out heretics and bringing them to book in front of church courts. So that's kind of the overall picture of the Middle Ages. There were also colleges and collegiate churches, but they weren't colleges like we think of today. But they were funded religious institutions that prayed for people's souls when they were paid by wealthy aristocrats. So that's that's kind of the structure of the church. And during the High Middle Ages came a period of, it was mentioned in the last lecture, of intellectual inquiry. There were a number of historic things that happened to begin the breakdown of the stranglehold that the papacy had on the church in a number of different ways. There were different countervailing currents within the church. And one of those was a renewed interest in the classics, in ancient Rome and ancient Greece and the classical writings and such. And universities sprang up, and they sprang up in Scotland. St. Andrews became the first in 1413, and it became a center of learning and a center of study. And it's really where the Reformation actually is going to begin as a result of it. They added more and more colleges as time went on. And then along came in the 14th century, middle of 14th century, Wycliffe and his followers, the Lollards, which we will learn about. Well, one thing we do know about them and in their relation to Scotland is after Wycliffe died, he had sent out his poor preachers all over the United Kingdom. It wasn't United Kingdom yet, but all over Britain, including North Britain. And we know this because there are records from the Inquisition. Inquisition was instituted in the Roman Catholic Church to sniff out heresies and punish heretics. And the Inquisition was very active in Scotland, and particularly the Dominicans were involved in that in Scotland. Extent, and they kept records, and we have records from Scotland from that period of the kind of central late Middle Ages. And there are some Lollards that were brought to trial and were questioned, and they gave the wrong answers, as they always did, because they knew what they knew from reading the Bible. And when they would be asked a question that, on which their life hung, they may or may not have understood it. Not the Lollards didn't tend to be educated, highly educated men who knew the cleverness of logical fallacies and the way that the lawyers asked questions. The lawyers asked questions in such a way that anybody who's accused of heresy is going to get convicted. They knew exactly how to ask the question so that the answer has to be wrong every time. And these poor Lollards that were caught were burned with the Bible hanging around their neck. And they were tried and convicted and burned. We know of the names of two of them in Scotland during the Middle Ages. And these weren't men who were reformers. This is well before the Reformation. These weren't men who were trying to overthrow the papacy or create a big stir. These were just men who were preaching the gospel as they understood it from the scriptures in the vernacular languages. And, as Luther once said when confronted with these kinds of issues, and they asked him, what was important, what was so important that a person would be burned at the stake for? And he said, Schrift, Schrift, Schrift. The scriptures, the scriptures, the scriptures. And then he said, I can't remember the German words for it, but he said, you hear me? The scriptures. And that's the way the Wycliffeites were, and they paid for it their lives. Well, with all of this intellectual ferment that begins to take place in the universities in the 14th, 15th, 16th century, in Scotland, in St. Andrews, there is a young, brilliant scholar by the name of Patrick Hamilton. He belonged to the very powerful Hamilton family, whose head was the Earl of Arran. He's one of the leading nobles of Scotland. At the age of 14, Patrick Hamilton received the commendatorship of the Abbey of Ferney in Rosher to enable him to study in Paris, where he graduated with a Master of Arts in 1520. He came under the influence of Erasmus and the new humanism, and returned to Scotland in 1523 to teach at St. Andrews in the Faculty of Arts. Well, while in Paris, he had come into contact not just with Erasmus, but with the writings of Martin Luther. And he was impressed with the biblical scholarship of Luther. And he reflected on that as he returned to Scotland and brought some of that material with him. And he became suspected of sympathy with Luther's teachings. And just to prove their point, he left St. Andrews and took himself off to Wittenberg and had a number of long conversations and learning sessions with Martin Luther and with Melanchthon. Eventually, he did return to Scotland to take up his duties. But by this time, he had been converted. And he was very solid Protestant in his convictions, having come over to the Lutheran Reformation pretty much in its entirety. And he came back and began preaching to the students at St. Andrew's the pure gospel. And in so doing, he ran afoul, of course, of the cardinal, the archbishop at this time, Archbishop Beaton. In 1528, Beaton summoned him to what he called a conference in St. Andrew's. He was interrogated for several days, was left at liberty, perhaps in the hope that he would again save himself by fleeing, for it might be dangerous to antagonize the Hamiltons. But instead, he spent the whole month lecturing in public and disputed in private until at last he was brought to a formal trial before Cardinal Beaton and others, and was condemned to the stake as a heretic. And his preaching was not at all connected to the clerical abuses or the scandals that were just all over the place in Scotland among the clergy. But he solely preached the positive religious and evangelical core of Reformation doctrine, especially justification by faith. That's what he preached about. He preached about the sola scriptura and sola fide and sola gratia. He didn't get up and condemn the monks for their mistresses. Cardinal Beaton had 10 children. He was celibate, of course. He had mistresses. They all did. The men of his ilk and a lot lower than him among the clergy at every level. But that's not what he preached against. He didn't preach against anything. He just preached the gospel. And that condemned him. He was 24 years old, and he was tied to the stake. And even though he was of noble birth and very gracious character, in fact, the students at this college thought it was a joke, that somebody was just kidding with them, tying up their professor like that, pretending to burn him at the stake, until they actually did burn him at the stake. And the wood was wet, and it wouldn't burn, and it was an absolutely agonizing death. They sprinkled gunpowder on him to make him burn up quicker. And he had made a huge impression on the students as a result. He had been preaching the gospel to them. And now they looked and they saw that Master Hamilton was willing to die for sola fide. He was willing to die for the gospel. And these corrupt cardinal, or the corrupt archbishop, and all of his minions were willing to, rather than debate or have a public colloquy, which Luther loved because he was so good at it, instead of doing that, which is what Luther had told Hamilton, you know, go back and debate these guys and try and persuade them, he was just summarily dismissed as a heretic and burned at the stake. They didn't want any debate over doctrine. And they especially didn't want anything that he might say that would prevent the pilgrims from coming to St. Andrews. One wit remarked to Cardinal Beaton, "The reek of Master Patrick Hamilton has infected everyone that it blew upon." And so it did. Well, then in 1534 came Henry VIII's definitive breach with Rome, followed 2 years later by his suppression of the English monasteries. And, of course, that is going to affect Scotland, too, because the Scots, kind of many of them, admire that particular plan. Around this time, the 1530s, a Scottish pastor, or a Scottish priest, who had gone to Geneva in Switzerland and had met up with John Calvin and had become really a very powerful witness to the gospel, returned from exile. His name was George Wishart. He was a son of an Angus Laird, educated at the University of Aberdeen. He had taught his pupils to read the New Testament in Greek, which as a college professor he could get away with at that time. He was threatened with a charge of heresy by the Bishop of Brecon. He fled to England, where he was protected by Archbishop Latimer. Exiled, became part of the Swiss Reformation, and then again came back to Scotland and began preaching all over Scotland. And he had a young man with him, another priest who had been converted, a man named John Knox. And he had got himself a big sword, and he wherever Master Wishart went, he went with him because he's going to protect him from the assassins. And all over Scotland, Knox followed Wishart and heard the most powerful preaching in Scotland. And the Inquisition was just two steps behind. Archbishop Beaton sent out his hitmen to get their hands on Wishart and get him to St. Andrews for trial. And they were closing in on him, finally. And hundreds of people have been converted all across Scotland from Wishart's preaching. It was running like gospel was running like wildfire wherever he went. And he told Knox to leave him. He ordered him away. He said, one sacrifice for the gospel in this place at this time is enough. God has greater things for you. And so Knox left Wishart. Wishart, in the next few days later, was seized, condemned, tried, and burned at the stake. When we go to Scotland, we go to St. Andrews, and there on the ground in front of St. Salvator's College are two big initials, PH, where Patrick Hamilton, on the spot where he was burned at the stake. And at the other end, remember, the Reformation is going to be successful in Scotland in ways that no other country experienced. So these have been shrines to these martyrs ever since. And there's another one for Wishart about 100 yards away where they burned him at the stake as well. I might say this about Archbishop Beaton. By the time of George Wishart, he was a cardinal. After he had Wishart burned at the stake, a number of men who had all kinds of issues with him, not just the burning of gospel preachers, but other things as well, burst into his chambers in the high part of the cathedral in the dead of night, a gang of men, and they stabbed him about 1,000 times and very seriously killed him and pitched him out the window. That's called defenestration in those days when you wanted to demonstrate your disagreement with somebody. If you pitched him out the window, I guess everybody gets the message. But they tied a rope around his neck. So there's the cardinal, stabbed hundreds of times by all these men, hanging from the cathedral window of his apartments. Well, that infuriated the regent, Queen Regent of Scotland, and she was French, Mary Guise, of the very Roman Catholic Guise family of France, and these men retreated into the castle there at St. Andrews and prepared to defend themselves to the death from the armies that were sent to quell this disturbance at St. Andrews and the assassination of the cardinal. The men in the castle, which there were several hundred, joined the assassins in this little rebellion, invited John Knox to come in and be their chaplain, and he did. And that's going to be a subject of my next talk, is what happens to John Knox and his particular influence. But when it comes to the Reformation in Scotland, just as was earlier said, the field was plowed and plowed and plowed, and the seeds were sown down through the centuries by unknown Lollards and other pockets of Christians. But then as the Reformation was beginning to dawn, college professors and priests like George Wishart were converted and became the harbingers of a great spiritual awakening that's going to sweep across Scotland. And, you know, when we think about it, a lot of these early converts, and this is going to be true, it's going to be true in every country that experiences Reformation. A lot of the early converts are monks and priests and men who have been trained, men who have at least a modicum of biblical understanding, some of them a lot, like Martin Luther, but men who were literate and were leaders already and were really prepared to step into the church, although they didn't understand it that way. But when the Reformation came, there was this kind of ready-made group of people whom God called to faith. I think the same thing happened with the church at Pentecost in the New Testament. Who were those early converts? Who were the pastors of those early churches? They were Pharisees that were converted. They were men whose lives were devoted to the Scriptures and spent their whole life studying the Bible. And now they knew what it meant. You know, the Apostle Paul came along and others, the apostles came and said, this is what the scriptures mean because of Christ. And there were a lot of converts. The Bible tells, the book of Acts tells us time and again. And among them were priests, among them were Pharisees who were converted. And I personally think they became the early pastors and elders of the early church. And the same thing happens in the Reformation among the clergy. And that would include John Knox, Martin Luther, Ulrich Zwingli, John Calvin, who started out as a lawyer also. All these men, many of them, had taken orders and were already prepared for what God had been preparing them for in the old church, in the corrupt church, for a new dawn of the gospel. Thank you.